Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, CEOs, clinicians, investors, lawyers, journalists who are changing the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners know, I am the CEO and co-founder of a health tech business myself called PocDoc. PocDoc has built the digital infrastructure to allow prevention to scale globally, and our Healthy Heart Check is now the number one diagnostic tool being used across the UK to screen for cardiovascular disease risk outside of GP surgery. So if you're interested in more, in hearing more about the Healthy Heart Check, please go to PocDoc.co. That's PocDoc.co. Or head to Boots, Pharmacy to You, Well, etc., where you can use it and get it yourself. Thank you, as always, to PocDoc for supporting the show. And thank you to everyone who is listening live on UK Health Radio. We love the live platform. UK Health Radio has a ton of other presenters doing amazing shows, so I would urge you to listen. Thank you if you are listening to this or watching this across any of the podcast channels or YouTube. So as of the last episode, we are now being broadcast in multiple languages. So we've cloned me, and I am now broadcasting this in French, German, Japanese, Spanish, and Arabic. So bonjour, guten tag, konnichiwa, hola, and salamu alaikum for all of our listeners across the world. We're now, I think, the most globally distributed health tech podcast in the world, which is really, really exciting. And thank you very much for listening. We have got a very special show today. So our guest today is Dr. Penny Dash, who is chair of NHS England. She began life, her career as a hospital doctor and then a public health leader. She then led McKinsey's health tech practice or healthcare practice across Europe, and she's steered NHS England through one of the biggest periods of change, both in the healthcare system and in society more widely. Just so we're all listening, as we know, we're a broad church. The chair of NHS England is probably one of the top four or five roles in global healthcare at any one time in terms of significance and importance. So it's a huge honour to get Penny onto the show. So Penny, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Steve.
Good. Right. So you clearly, the narrative thread that runs through your whole career is that you really care deeply about improving the healthcare system, whether that's been done, you know, in your roles at NHS England, in public health, McKinsey, etc. And whenever I meet you and we talk, and whenever I hear you on stage, you're a voice of optimism. You're a realist. You never sugarcoat anything, but you always find a way, however difficult things are, to take an optimistic view of things. So over the last 25 years, how have you managed to keep that optimism, that flame burning through such periods of tumultuous change? Let's start there.
Well, it's actually a lot more than 25 years, because I'm quite old. So it's more like about 45 years.
I went low.
Like, always a good thing. I think because I know it sounds glib and lots of people say this, but it is because I do feel really strongly about it. And I can see all of the potential for things to be better. Mm-hmm. And that's not just me saying I have some, you know, secret skill to see that. It's because I like listening to people. I find people, I read, I'm always reading, particularly news magazines. I'm less good at reading proper books. But I'm always reading, I'm always trying to learn. For whatever reason, I've always had an inquisitive mind. Mm. And when I look at what's happening, you know, even 40 years ago, 45 years ago, the different sorts of healthcare that were out there, the differences in the way in which people interact with healthcare, the differences, even though we didn't really talk about it quite so much, but we still, you know, we spoke a lot about things like smoking cessation 45 years ago, the way in which different people find it easier to adopt healthier lifestyles. All of that gives me great hope, because you can actually see that we could have a much better healthcare system. And over that 45 years, it has got dramatically better, which is quite easy to forget. And so I do think, in fact, I feel quite strongly that over the next 45 years, I mean, oh my goodness, I won't live to see what is likely coming downstream.
Well, you don't know. You might be at the forefront of these life extending. We might need to keep Penny Dash around a little bit longer. You might be number one in the life extending.
I'm not sure about that therapy. But I can only imagine that it's going to evolve even further.
Okay.
But as you say, I'm a realist. And I recognise that change, not everyone's comfortable with change, and that has been a big learning over the last 45 years. And I've changed dramatically because of that. Mm. You know, I've gone from being probably quite a sort of ardent campaigner. I was a big campaigner in my youth. I've then, my sort of 30s, probably thought the louder you speak, the more likely things will happen.
Okay.
And now I recognise it's much more nuanced than that. So I can see that change is hard. People often feel uncomfortable about change, and that's why it can be quite hard to adapt.
Over that 45-year period, which other countries, if any, would you actually swap healthcare systems with? You know what I mean? Like, we talked about this before the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And I believe, having, you know, worked in the NHS and what we do at PopDoc for a while, and, you know, my mum worked in the NHS for 30 years and things like that, but having now gone overseas with PopDoc and speaking to other people in other healthcare systems, it's not like there's a clear winner outside the UK either.
No. Well, you've just answered the question.
Well, yeah, but what would you know, what do you think?
I definitely don't think there's a clear winner. What I do think is that there are things that we do here in the NHS which are absolutely globally leading edge and other countries are really interested in and seek to adopt. Mm. There are things that happen in other countries around the world which we should absolutely be adopting. And the things that I would tend to point to would be, I think New Zealand has done a very good job on tech.
They
did a lot quite early on, so probably around, I don't know, 2010, something like that. They're quite early adopters of electronic health records, of capturing data, using the fact it's not a similar system to ours, so single payer model. Did a lot of work on public health, a lot of work with primary care. So I think that's, New Zealand's always an interesting one because it's quite analogous. There are elements of Australia which have been very impressive. Some of their innovation in primary care is interesting. I'm not necessarily saying you would adopt it quite as it is, but they have quite a different payment model. Which
is it insurance-based or partial insurance-based down there?
It's a mix.
It's a mix.
So roughly, these numbers won't be accurate.
We won't hold your feet to the fire on the numbers,
but
listeners.
But about 50% of people have private health insurance.
Okay.
But there are things I would not adopt from Australia, like they have very, very high cost healthcare.
Okay.
So unit costs are very high. Mm. And as a result, increasingly more and more people can't afford insurance, because if the unit costs of delivering healthcare are very high, then the insurance premium is going to go up.
Yep.
So they're in quite an interesting model where they, if you looked at our unit costs versus their unit costs, we're in a much better place. We're delivering better health care outcomes for the amount of money that we spend. But some of the things that they do are interesting, and we should be willing to look at that. So that's there. I think if you go to Southeast Asia, Singapore, everyone always says, you know, really interesting how they have all the things that we've spoken about over the last 25 years, like shift left, develop good models of community care, neighborhood care, adopt technology, they've just done.
Yeah. I mean, I think what's interesting about when you look, and I've already gone off the agenda for the show, but this is what we do, so that's fine. But the interesting thing, at least about two of the countries you mentioned, so Singapore and New Zealand, have very small populations.
Very small population.
I mean, New Zealand's highly rural, or significantly more rural than Singapore is.
Exactly.
So Singapore is basically a single party state city.
Absolutely.
Which means you can do quite a lot, and you don't necessarily have to worry too much about canvassing opinion and things.
And on top of that, very strong public cohesion about things like not smoking and so on. So therefore, if you go, you know, skirt over those, and then you come to, India.
Mm.
Oh my goodness. So India is off.
Is it?
I think India is probably going to become the global exemplar in healthcare provision.
Oh, wow. I love this. Do go on. That's amazing. Go for it. Yeah. Let's have it.
So they, as in many, many other things, they love their tech.
Yeah.
And so technology in healthcare in India, I suspect, is, you know, there's some cool stuff happening in the US, obviously, but India is just off. And they are using technology in ways that the US could only dream of. and we could only dream of. And more, which I think is of interest to us here, they're doing it in a way, which I really like this term, democratizes access to healthcare.
Okay.
And they feel very strongly about that. Many of the founders of tech firms and the managers and the doctors working in healthcare delivery. So by using technology, you can reduce the unit cost of care. And it's not just, technology now was standardized operating processes 20 years ago.
Okay.
And they were very early and standardized operating processes. Mm. And are now tech-enabled those standardized operating processes. Mm. And so they are delivering outstandingly good healthcare for dramatically lower unit costs than almost anyone else globally.
With unbelievably huge populations society challenges and things like that.
Yeah. So, wow.
Yeah.
Is the main thing. Wow. So that's going to be very interesting. Watch that space. And then as we move west, of course, Europe... definitely the payer model in Germany, the way in which they've used data and analytics, some really interesting ways in which they purchase healthcare, think about the costs of healthcare.
The thing I like about, I spent a lot of my life in Germany, bilingual German, and actually last week I was over in Germany, as we look to expand PocDoc in that region. And one of the things that I really, really am enjoying about the public healthcare, the public insurer model, is that the entire standard of care is contracted.
That's right.
With absolute clarity.
Yeah.
With very little flexibility around it, which is some people might complain about, but actually it provides a really clear basis to go forward because it's a blueprint and the blueprint doesn't really change.
Yeah.
I think that's really refreshing.
Yeah. And they do some really interesting contracting things that, again, we should be looking at more. So if they have a long waiting list for a particular surgical procedure. I mean, all this stuff is easier to do in surgery than in medicine. But they put the price up. They say, we'll pay more.
Oh, they can flex it, can they?
They absolutely. They flex the tariff.
Really?
Yeah. And then if they have more and more providers coming into that space, which we definitely have in some areas, they then lower the price.
Wow.
So they're managing the market.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. So we, in theory, have some elements of a market, not totally, but we have some elements, particularly around elective surgery, which we treat the market. But we don't flex the tariff based on how big the waiting list is. So they do that. And then they do a very good job of doing utilization reviews.
Okay.
So actually checking if this hospital puts in a bill for this or this private provider puts in a bill for this. Did they actually do it? And crucially, did it meet the threshold?
Right.
So they're using data and analytics to continually check,
their auditing is top notch.
Exactly. So they're saying, are we getting what we think we've paid for? And then flexing price as well. So that's very interesting what they do in Germany. I think they have issues in other areas. They have overprovision of quite a lot of services, which is why they have to do that. Mm. Try and manage, because you don't want supplier-induced demand.
No.
So they do a good job of that. And then, of course, the Nordic countries, I still think, are some of the most interesting for us to look at.
Yeah, in terms of innovation adoption and prevention, I suspect, as well.
Primary prevention, strong sense of social cohesion. Sweden, which I'd recommend to anyone interested in this, very interesting article in the Wall Street Journal.
Okay.
Looking at primary care in Sweden. It was published in about May time, something like that. And looking at how... bit as we've got here, sort of increasingly quite a big range of offers in the primary care space, which can be digital offers, some of the things you're doing.
Yep.
Things like online primary care, right the way through to more traditional models of primary care, but almost opening up that market so that you don't just have to go to your registered GP, you can actually choose who you go to and still have it covered through the state model.
I mean, I think that I love getting technical on this show, as listeners will know, but this idea, when you really focus on the idea of reimbursement and you look at the unit that is being reimbursed, and if you're able to get healthcare to that point, that opens up a lot of flexibility.
Absolutely.
And a lot more adaptability.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure necessarily you might tell me I'm wrong, whether the NHS is at that point, at this point in any area, but I don't know. But that does seem to me to unlock a lot of downstream benefits in other systems.
It does. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that these are all the things that we should be looking at more. Yeah. And we should be thinking, well, if they do that there, why can't we do it here? Because we've got quite similar public sector ethos, and so on. And then, of course, if we go to Canada and the US. So Canada has quite a lot of challenges, which I think people often don't really realise. So they struggle with waiting lists, they struggle with access to primary care, probably more so than we do. Mm-hmm. So again, sometimes quite easy to get down on what we've got, but Canada has its own struggles. It's quite, again, quite similar system to ours. And they are really interested in learning from us. That would be quite a good example of somewhere that's interested in what are you doing? How can we learn from that? And then, of course, we go to the US, and I always think it's a shame that everyone thinks that the US is this fully privatized system.
No,
when of course it isn't.
No.
You know, 50% of US healthcare is paid for by the state. Mm. The problem is that it is not universal, and that is, I think, pretty terrible. Many people would say it's awful. And when you go and you see the health need and the poor health status of so many people, it's difficult to see that in such a rich country.
Yeah.
But some of the ways, again, of thinking about different models of care, the way in which technology can be used, different contracting mechanisms are very, very interesting. And as ever in the US, that can-do culture means that people come up with an idea, think about doing something differently, and then do it. And that then means it gives us some really interesting real-life case studies, essentially, to look at and learn from.
So on that topic, how do you feel that the system here embraces or not the opportunity to try different things? Is it a culture of trying things or a culture of not trying things or a bit of both? Depends on the day of the week and depends on what's your take on the whole thing?
Yeah. I mean, in many, many ways, we have an absolutely outstandingly brilliant healthcare system, in that there are doctors, nurses, physios, managers out there, A, delivering outstandingly good care in many, many places, and B, thinking through how could we do things differently, and C, going around the world looking at all of those things, albeit through a particular lens. Mm-hmm. Now, I think more people should be looking at the sorts of things I'm talking about, but we do tend to have, you know, doctors in particular do a lot of going off to conferences and learning about what's happening in terms of new treatments. And then D, my final one, is we have a fantastic history of evaluating things.
That is true. And that is widely worldwide renowned.
Absolutely. And we shouldn't lose that. Now, there are things in all of that which I think we could do better on, but we should recognise we start from a point of strength. So if that's all the good stuff, and you know, I can see and you can see and lots of people can see, I could name all sorts of examples of that. But I can also absolutely see that some of the challenges we have about pace of adoption. And that is really frustrating. Well, I can see two big things. One is people with great ideas, new product, great ideas within the system, new products being developed within the system or outside the system, who struggle to get them adopted in the first place, can't even find a way in, can't find someone to speak to. And then on top of that, the problems of scaling things up and more widespread adoption of what we know is good practice.
Well, this tension between innovation and adoption we'll go into in the second part of the show, but I'm going to stop right now for our first commercial break of this week's Health Tech Hour with my amazing guest, Dr. Penny Dash, NHS England Chair, rather. We will be right back in 2 minutes. Don't go anywhere.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your worst dreams aren't your enemy?
Falling, cheating, being chased, naked, drowning, losing teeth. What if I fail? What if something goes wrong?
I'm Teresa Chung, dream expert, best-selling author, and co-host of The Healing Power of Your Dreams. And in my latest title, Extreme Dreaming, I reveal a powerful truth. There are no bad dreams.
That feels so real, but that's so you remember them.
They're messages, signals, transformative gifts guiding you toward clarity.
Click on the Extreme Dreaming discount banner link on UK Health Radio homepage and learn to decode even your darkest dreams.
Extreme Dreaming.
Are you ready to listen?
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Health Tech Hour with my guest, Dr. Penny Dash, Chair of NHS England. So we picked up just right at the end was this tension or potential tension between innovation, good ideas, which can come from inside the system, they can come from outside the system, they can be clinical, they can be non-clinical, they can be med device, they can be non-med, they could be anything, it's lots of different things. And this idea of adoption, which for the sake of this discussion, let's talk about adoption in terms of spread, uptake, you know. And so what's your kind of take on this tension, if at all?
Yeah, so again, trying to put a bit of context and history around this. So people always used to talk about 17 years.
I heard that. That's ridiculous. Yeah.
So, and there was some good data for that and some good studies. And it takes 17 years from someone somewhere figuring out a better way to do things before it getting widespread. And you know, and if we went back into time, some really quite staggering things, you know, like way in which you treat, do an appendectomy, or way in which women were looked after during pregnancy, you know, many, many things. And you look at it now and you think, oh my goodness, how do we possibly do those things? Yeah. And why did it take long to stop doing them? Really, you know, interesting. And this 17 years actually was, you could see it almost. You could see it live. You could absolutely see, well, why hasn't this caught on, and why are people still so far behind? So that 17 years, I think, would be hard to find examples of that now, the 17 years. So
I mean, gut feel, I'd agree with you.
Yeah. So we definitely, I think that has come down significantly, and that has been helped by things like NICE has played a really big role. So essentially developing clinical guidelines into best practice care or good practice care, and then disseminating them fairly rapidly.
You know what? I'll give a quick shout out to the guys at NICE. So on those, on that clinical guidelines thing. So one of the most instructive things that someone told us when we started with PocDoc was, have you guys looked at the NICE clinical guidelines for your area? And we were really, I mean, we were like a few days old at this point, and we, and I thought, oh, that's probably a good plan, let's go have a looky look. And to your point, NICE publish clinical guidelines for every single condition in flowcharts and beautiful text and things like that, and keep it up to date, which tells you exactly how that area is delivered, and therefore you can then work out how your thing fits into it. There isn't another healthcare system that does that, by the way.
No, exactly.
It's so totally unique and free.
Yeah. So that has made a massive difference. Then the whole principle of medical audit and clinical audit. So this was an area I was quite militant on in my younger days.
On the barricades. Okay.
Couldn't quite believe why this seemed to be such a, I mean, but it literally was. 1990, when people started to talk about medical audit, the opposition to it was unbelievable.
What do you mean by medical audit?
Let's measure what we did and did it work.
Oh, wow. That's it.
That's it.
That's it.
Let's maybe say we've just done this appendectomy in, you know, 100 people over the last year. Let's see how many of them had post-op infection, how many of them had some other form of complication, and let's compare one hospital to another.
And that was 35 years ago. People were freaking out about the idea of
introducing it. Absolutely freaking out about it.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, massive, massive opposition to it. Massive opposition to measuring and comparing.
Was that driven through fear of liability?
Well, all sorts of things. You know, I'm too good for anyone to measure what
how,
I
went to medical school, and how dare you?
How dare you? You know, a lot of that. And then also there are some valid concerns, like, are you fully case mix adjusting? And so that's always a big one. You know, you're going to have different outcomes in centres that look after people with more complex needs.
And if it's a league table situation and I see really unhealthy patients, my results will look worse than, you know, Johnny surgeon down the road who sees healthy people.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. So, you know, all of that, very valid, but in some ways put the valid issues out there, don't put the unwise issues. So, you know, a lot of this stuff has changed significantly. Things like GERF done a fantastic job.
Get it right first time, listeners. Get it right first time.
Really impressive program, sort of almost resurrected the whole principle of audit. Let's look at what we're doing, modernized it, put a lot of energy into that. So there's been all these different things which have made a massive difference to that 17 years. And so it'd be cancer networks be another good one, cardiac networks, lots of those things. So many, many things which have really helped and improved adoption. But, and this is a big but, we still have a long way to go. And we have a long way to go for in two ways. So one is we've still got massive variation. And that cannot be right. And I think we're too tolerant of that massive variation. You wouldn't see that in other industries.
You mean between different regions doing things differently? Is that what you mean?
Between different hospitals, between different GP practices, between individual GPs, between individual nurses, between individual surgeons, between individual physicians. Far too much variation. And we know it's there because we can see it, and recently we've got the data to do it. So that, we've still got a long way to go to address that. And then the second bit is that the whole way in which I've been talking is, of course, old world way. About, well, let's measure this and see if we can see this. Well, the more that we start to look after people and have underpinning technology behind that, whether it's electronic health records or much more so as we start to use some things like ambient voice technology that accurately captures the interaction that then weaves in some of the results from diagnostic tests, we ought to be able to do a dramatically better job of actually having much more accurate data, really being able to properly case mix adjust that, because we've got all the patient information there. We know exactly what was their blood pressure, their pulse, their weight,
their lipid levels, their Q risk,
all of it. And then we can really start to compare, well, what's happening here, there, and look at that. And then, of course, where I think we will get to, and we can already see it happening, is that then the technology will dictate what the care pathway should look like.
And is that starting to happen, that last little bit, that last bit? Is it, or are we in the foothills of that?
We're in the foothills of it, but it is definitely out there. So you can definitely see already lots of development of lots of digital tools that say, you know, if someone's got A, B, C, D, then this is what the right care pathway should be. And indeed, you as a user, you can look that up. NHS Online will give you a lot of that data. But if you put it into, even on Google, whatever that AI is that is at the start of Google, that will start to say, well, if you've got these symptoms, then you should be doing this. So you as a patient really do now have quite a lot of data that says this is what should be happening in this particular case.
Yes.
That you can then use in your interaction. Now, there's also lots of negatives of that, which we could come on to.
But it creates a different pressure that the system's not had to deal with before, which is highly empowered. Highly informed, whether it's accurate or not. That's a big area of debate. Patients that believe themselves to be really informed and how it deals with that is a really interesting area.
And you look at things like, which we've had for a while, but get better and better as the tech gets better, things like GP systems that can look at drug interactions, that can say, maybe this patient shouldn't be on this drug if they're already on these two. So that is only going to go in one direction. It's going to get more and more and more sophisticated.
So on the issue of patient data, there's been, I think everyone broadly agrees that a single patient record is like a net good idea. I think.
Not everyone.
No? I thought we got at least conceptually that a single patient record was a good idea. We're not even that point. A large amount of people believe that a single digital source of truth for a patient record is a net good place to be. So what do you, is this a bit like your example about the medical audit situation? Because there's a lot of pushback seemingly in and around this space around there's different arguments and different points being made, but it just seems like a lot of like negativity that might be holding back the progress to this end goal, whoever or however we ultimately execute that. But I don't know what your thoughts are.
Yeah, there is, and I think it's sad. It's been going on for a long time. I mean, it goes right back to what I was saying from 1990 when there was resistance to this. It's the same groups of people. It's such a shame, because it then just spreads misinformation, and you start getting, you know, people who are genuinely nervous because they genuinely think that their healthcare data, which may contain things that they may not have shared with other people, they genuinely think that there is a high risk of that data being put out in the public domain if we move to a single patient record. And you know, of course there are going to be some risks. Nothing in life is risk-free. But the advantages of having that data are so phenomenal to the individual, to future development of care and of science, that it would be so sad to not be able to get this through.
And also the adoption curve of new technology massively steepens if you're able to unlock access to large quantities of patient data to be able to use with those tools or products and things like that. Because, you know, at the moment, in order to access patient data, you have to go GP surgery to GP surgery and sign data sharing agreements, which is fine. And everyone knows that's the system, and that's what we do. That's just how it goes. But if you want to really lean into some of these new technologies in a very safe and very controlled way, with all the safeguards and checks and balances in place, obviously, then that's a very, very rocky road.
Yep.
To have to do that. I remember the day when I found out that the primary care record, the GP record, was not the same as the hospital care record. I remember finding that out. I was like, what? What? And then, that's a whole nother area, right?
Oh, good. Well, so recently, I'll share this with you. Well, so I'll give you two things. So one was one of the most devastating moments of my career. In about 1995, I did some work with different organizations starting to develop some of the first wave of electronic health records. And I presumed, clearly erroneously, but I just presumed that the way in which one would build up a health record is you would do it, because this was what was starting to evolve in other things, you'd do it almost through drop-down screens.
Mm-hmm.
So you come and see me as a doctor, and I would put in your name. It would go male, female, do that, you know, date of birth, or someone else would put that in. And then, you know, it would say, what are your symptoms? And you'd be chest pain, you know, is it radiating down your arm? Or the classic way in which you're taught through the whole of medical school, highly structured approach to taking notes.
Yep.
And you'd build up the electronic health records such that you could just do drop-down screens on all of those questions. Very much like now, if you have to fill out a health questionnaire, it asks you all those questions.
Yeah.
You know. So I presume that's what it would be. And it was about 10 years later when I realized that our great electronic health records by all of these massive, very supposedly successful global companies were just a place that people put PDFs.
Oh, wow. Really?
Yeah. And so you go into your electronic health record
now.
If you go onto NHS app, there will be embedded PDFs there from possibly 10 years ago.
Ugh.
And that's what it will be, PDFs. It won't...
So unqueryable.
Unqueryable. You know, so instead of us having this amazing set of data now that would allow us to really understand what are the root causes of some different diseases. Why do some people get this? Why do some people get that? And even more so, why is this treatment effective in some people and not in others? All of this stuff that we could be doing, you can do a bit of it through searching the PDFs, but you can't do anything like what you would do if you got the raw data in there.
No, of course not.
So that has been a big disappointment. That's one. And then the second.
Have you checked the PDFs, Penny? Just have a look at those first before.
And then the second is I had a family member in a hospital, very good hospital, NHS hospital, and was promised that they would be able to access everything that happened to them, including all their, you know, results,
sure,
all the different diagnostic tests, through the hospital data system.
Okay. All right.
So then you go on to that. Well, now you need a login, you need your number, you've got to set up a password.
Right.
You get this. We'll come back to you with we'll have approved your login within 24 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Well.
Yeah. Well, and anyway, also the hospital's got an IT department that's managing that, and, you know, like...
Exactly very user-friendly, is it? And this is meant to be one of the good ones.
Right.
I think, well, maybe it'll be on the app.
Mm.
So you go in the app, and yeah, half the data's on the app. But wow, only half the data is on the app. So isn't this ridiculous? Yeah. It's 2026.
Yeah.
And some of your data's on your NHS app.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I've been and had a blood test and then it turns up on the app within a few hours, I go, wow, this is
That's
fantastic.
An incredible experience.
Isn't it? You know, we're moving forward and I can look back and I can see, again, mm-hmm, not very searchable. I can't turn it into a graph, which I'd like to do.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you always compare it with financial services.
Yep.
So financial services, yep, you can do a little graph of what's happened in your bank account, you know, mm-hmm, how many pairs of shoes have you bought, yep, whatever it might be. It would be nice to be able to do that, but, you know, we'll get there. But the fact that it's a different place to go,
mm,
for the NHS app to the hospital, mm, data system, as you say, is a,
yeah, I remember when I found that, yeah, one out and I was like, oh, that doesn't sound efficient to me.
Exactly.
It doesn't, on the face of it,
exactly,
that doesn't sound optimal. Right, then we're going to go for our last commercial break with my guest today, Dr. Penny Dash, and then we will be right back. So don't go anywhere.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving, it's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
Somewhere on Earth, there are 4 acres that belong to you. You don't need to be there in person, only there in purpose, protecting it, defending it, keeping it alive. Because the world doesn't need more good intentions. It needs more meaningful actions. Register your interest at 4acresearth.com.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost, and my guest today, Dr. Penny Dash, who is the chair of NHS England. So, what do you think that there's a real conversation that has to happen in terms of the social contract between the NHS and the wider public about what to expect? Or do you believe the expectations are kind of in line? Or like, what's your view around this type of... Because the NHS is an amazing institution, unbelievable. And it's like, for anyone who's still alive, it's pretty much always been there, give or take. But it feels like it's being asked to do more and more and more with changing societal needs. I don't know whether you think that that is reflected in the social contract that people in the UK have with it, or what's your kind of take on that?
Yeah. I always feel slightly uncomfortable with this conversation.
Okay.
Because many people say what you've just said, including many people in the system.
Right.
And it started off about 20 years ago. And we started to put notices on, we, the NHS, started to put notices on buses.
Okay.
You know, if you've got a cold, you don't need to go to A&E.
Oh, yeah, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And people felt really strongly about this. And that, at the time, that was the discussion about the social contract with the NHS. And we need to, you know, tell people to behave more responsibly and not turn up at A&E if they've got a cold. And I've often thought about that. And I've always, as I said, I've felt a bit uncomfortable because I thought, well, isn't that our job in the NHS? Because if you turn up at A&E with a cold, then, and we think you could be looked after better somewhere else, like in your own home with some Lemsip tucked up in bed, then it's our job to help you do that.
Right.
So I don't really quite like this thing about telling. I think that our system should enable people to actually receive the most appropriate care in the most appropriate way.
Yep.
So I sort of think before we...
I think that's a good interpretation of it. I think that's a good response. Yeah.
Before we start lecturing people, let's just, you know, almost sort out our own services.
Yeah.
And so I do think, because we still have some of that going on, that's because we haven't done as good a job as we could.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up 111. We've got NHS online. Well, if, despite having all of that, people with a cold are still turning up at A&E, that means those systems aren't working.
Yeah.
Because we ought to have a way that you can't turn up at A&E without going through those systems.
Like a triage concept.
Exactly. Mm. And that's how other countries would deal with this. Or they'd put in place different incentives or different models or different types of information to support it.
In an insurance-based system, you can't go and... otherwise, it doesn't get covered, basically.
Exactly.
If you don't check in with your insurer before you go...
Yeah. Now, I don't think we want to do that.
No.
But there are certainly ways in which we could be helping people to interact with the system in a much better way. So that's one bit. All of that said, I maybe started to evolve a bit more my thinking. And some of the things that I think are quite hard now are, obviously, there's some big challenges around obesity.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do we support people on that? But all the data would suggest that most people who are overweight or obese do not want to be overweight or obese.
I'm not shocked by that statement. No. I would imagine that, gut feel says that's right.
So again, I think it's how do we as a society, and it's not just the healthcare system clearly, how do we as a society do a much better job of supporting people to eat healthily and take care of
themselves? This is one of the things that I've always wondered. It's obviously above my pay grade, which is fine, but that food policy doesn't really sit anywhere underneath or within health policy, it doesn't sit. It sits under DEFRA, I think, technically.
Well, no, it does a bit. There was a team within the Department of Health and Social Care who are responsible for obesity in the widest sense, but do have to work with other government departments.
Okay.
Because then there are, you know, as with most things, there are wider sets of interactions, and you're getting into discussions with food manufacturers and supermarkets. But I do think, you know, we ought to be able to, as a society, do a better job on that. So that would be one. And then I think I've come back to a bit where I started. One of the things which I think is one of the biggest risks and biggest, it is a risk and it's a challenge, is on this increasing amount of information that is out there and erroneous information. And that is then when I do start to really change my thinking a bit. But again, the same principles probably apply. But it is what I witness now is a lot of the health information which is out there. You know, I guess some of it turns up on my Instagram feeds, or you can see it online, or you know, you hear from other people, and it is frankly misleading, and it is wrong, and it is resulting in quite a lot of demand in the health service. It's whipping up fears.
Can you put a quantification on the amount of demand that you think is due to misinformation, or is that too busy? You can't do that.
I don't know. Yeah.
But enough to notice in the data.
Enough to notice, yeah. Okay. And, you know, and some of it is, yes, we want to have, you know, we want people to be aware of their own health. We want people clearly to be aware of, is something wrong? Do I need to get help? Do I need to get some advice? But sometimes it's got so extreme that, you know, the real risk is that we've just got floods of people asking for advice, asking for diagnostic tests, when the data just does not support the use of that. And if we want to have, which we all do want to have in this country, a free at the point of use, universal healthcare system, which the overwhelming majority of people feel very passionate about, as indeed do I, then we need to find a way in which we can support more appropriate use.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because there's one argument, which is the genie doesn't go back in the bottle.
No, absolutely.
Kind of concept. And you know, I feel like well-meaning, though, discussions, and I'm not saying these discussions are happening, I'm hypothesizing, but discussions between, you know, the mechanics of state in the UK with social media platforms and things like that, I'm sure they're happening. I'm not really sure whether they're going to get very far in the grand scheme of, because it's a fire hose of content. It's really difficult to determine algorithmically whether one post about something is accurate or another post about something isn't accurate when it's basically a fire hose. And I feel like the NHS sometimes has a bit of a raw deal, because not only is it the provider of care, it also is being told it also has to be the champion of accurate information about care as well.
Exactly.
Which means you have to have a fully fledged comms machine out there kind of fighting fires and communicating things. It's really difficult. It's a very difficult spot.
It is. But again, actually, room to be optimistic here.
Yeah, let's be optimistic. You're right.
So the tech could help us here.
Okay.
So if I take some of the things that are happening live now, is it's a lot easier now than it was 10 years ago, 20 years ago, certainly 30 years ago, to decide, as some people are doing, I'm going to go and have a whole health check, I'm going to have a health screen, I'm going to do these blood tests.
Get a healthy heart check.
And do all sorts of things. Well, some of the healthy heart checks, right? But you've seen people do these things at a younger and younger age.
Yeah.
And public health doctor in me, and actually the NHS doctor in me, would say, oh, this is, you know, this isn't good. We're going to have no end of incidental findings.
Mm-hmm.
And that is true.
Yep.
You go down this route of all these health checks, you will absolutely find an abnormal blood test. You'll find your kidneys are funny shape. You'll find, you know, you've got a bit of this, you've got a bit of that. You know, your right leg is a little bit shorter than your left leg.
Okay.
You'll find it all.
Yeah.
And the problem at the moment is, once you've found it, you've found it.
Yes.
You know, once you've read it, you've read it. Once you've seen it, you've seen it.
Mm.
And you therefore then, you know, and again, lots of NHS doctors are fantastic at saying, oh, this is nothing.
Right.
This really is nothing. But at times people think, oh, well, you know, there's always the 1 in 100,000 where it maybe is something. So I better refer you on for some more tests and some more tests and some more tests. And that's the path that we're on a bit at the moment.
Okay.
And you can see that in things like referrals for cancer.
Right.
You know, that's gone from where 1 in 10 people referred for cancer would actually have cancer.
Okay.
So this is urgent cancer referrals.
Right.
9 out of 10 would not have cancer.
Okay. Right.
Now,
yeah,
that's down to 9. Well, then a few years ago, it was 19 out of 20 wouldn't have cancer.
Okay.
And now it's becoming even less. So,
wow.
In other words, we're referring more and more people because more and more people are becoming health aware and concerned and think I might have cancer.
Yeah, and this is through the urgent pathway where there's a hard cap on the response rate on the end. It's like 2 weeks or something.
Absolutely.
2 weeks, something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Now, in some ways, it's a good thing because we want more people to come forward and so on.
Yeah.
But you can also see the risk is it floods the system and then the people who really have got cancer struggled to get it.
I think the prostate cancer, PSI, is a classic example.
It's a classic one.
Yeah.
And it raises anxiety and concern. And then if you go down this route, there's a bit of something, we probably not anything, but we better check it out. There's then side effects often from those tests. The more invasive you get, you start sticking needles into things, start doing biopsies. Yeah.
Well, the prostate cancer biopsy is renowned as being a very, very invasive and unpleasant experience.
So there's all these sorts of things. Now, actually, so we're at the moment we're in a difficult place because we're sort of half using technology and half using these things, and people are becoming much more informed about their health, all of which is good, but the risk is these are the risks. Now, as the tech gets better and as the data gets better, exactly what we're talking about, we ought to be able to start to do a much better job of saying, actually, we've now got the data that says if you're 35 and you've got A, B, C, D, E, it's highly, highly, highly unlikely to be anything.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, We don't need to go on and do all of these things. Whereas if you've got some of these other things, then actually it is worthwhile pursuing this. Mm. And so that's my optimistic bit.
Well, that goes back around to having a consolidated patient record with that information in it.
Yeah. And and not just the health information, but wouldn't it be amazing if we had information on everything that we're all eating?
That would be great.
So we could probably put to bed some of the the continual. I mean, I'm sure you have. Every single time you read the news online, there's another, eat these five things, don't eat these six things.
My favourite is like these three things lower cholesterol within 3 weeks.
That's okay. Right, yeah. I'm going to do these. I'm about to do 48 hours of the German porridge diet.
Are you? Okay.
I'm going to give it a go.
Good luck with that one. Good luck.
But, you know, we could get much better at that. So if we had all of that data, we had all of our family history, we had all of our medical data, plus we had the continual monitoring of your blood pressure, your pulse, all these basic things like your cholesterol and hemoglobin, actually all really straightforward things to do, we'd build a fantastic data set. And actually, in my optimistic mood, we could remove a lot of health anxiety.
Yeah, because you can get ahead of it.
You can get ahead of it.
You can explain it.
And you'd actually say all of this is completely normal.
Yep, yep. I think the thing that we spoke about before the show that leaves me with a huge amount of optimism is that the conversations that you know we're having, for just sample of one, are much more geared around how do you look at an entire population that could be at risk and put in place screening programs that not just test, but also then connect into things that could have an impact. And actually, there's really deep discussions happening around changing the economic reimbursement from an upfront per patient cost to actually paying for the outcome, which you know works with platforms like us because we can track it all the way through. Yep. And I think that's the direction of travel that has to be leaned into across everything.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Cool. Well, look, one of the things that we do ask everyone that comes on the show at the end of the show is what's the motto or the self-talk that you've used over your career when you've been really in difficult spots that you want to kind of share with the world that people might take something from if they're also in a difficult spot? Bearing in mind, you're not allowed to swear, but you can, you know, we can bleep it out probably, but I don't know if that's the way you're going to go.
So I've definitely had plenty of difficult spots.
I bet.
Definitely. I think, finding a way to somehow just try and take the edge out of it is the really big thing. And different people do that in different ways. For me, it's definitely go for a walk, go for a swim. I don't like running, so I don't do that. But you know, some people.
But you can run, listeners. That's okay.
Yeah. Other choices are available. Hot bath.
Right.
You know, probably a small glass of wine and a good night's sleep, and talking to people.
Okay.
And just trying to put things in context. So it's sort of big, deep breath. In other words, let's wait a minute. Things can be difficult for days or even weeks, and I've definitely had that at times, not quite sure, you know, where's all this going. But I think somehow, and one of the most interesting things which I see and I worry about, I think many people, there was a really interesting Financial Times article on this again a few weeks ago, many people over the age of 40 can put the ups and downs of life into context and can do the sorts of things I've just been talking about and come out the other side and say, you know, there'll be another day and I'll have another shot at it. Or if I don't, then...
This too shall pass.
This too shall pass, exactly. Or, you know, it was meant to be and I'll move on. And one of the big concerns around younger people's mental health is they seem less able to do that.
Mm.
And things sort of, you know, become or are perceived to be a cause of mental health problems. And I think we owe it to the younger generation to try and find a way through that.
I agree. I completely agree. That's one of the things that I try and work on with my kids specifically, because you can see that in the data and also qualitatively. Right, Penny, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Pleasure.
Dr. Penny Dash, our wonderful guest on this week's show, will be back again with a show next week. Thank you so much for listening. And yes, for all of our listeners that are listening to me talking Japanese, Arabic, French, Spanish, and German, well, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much.